The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Laura Prendergast.
And today we are delighted to be joined by Amir Kotecha. Amir is a chef and food writer and a regular contributor to The Spectator. He's also First Secretary at the UK Foreign Office. And his first book, the Platinum Jubilee Cookbook, Recipes and Stories from Her Majesty's Representatives Around the World, will be published on the 28th of April. Amir, welcome to Table Talk.
Thanks very much for having me.
And as listeners know, we always start with the same question, which is, what are your earliest memories of food?
Well, I don't know if it's my very first memory, but I do have a very vivid memory of sitting in the family kitchen on the tabletop, licking the inside of a cake batter bowl when my mother was baking. So it was one of those brown mason cash bowls that probably everyone knows. And yeah, I just have a very vivid memory of that. It was this green linoleum floored kitchen. The floor was always sticky, I think, sort of years and years of pasta sauces and all that sort of thing probably splattered on the floor. But yeah, very vivid memory of that. And it's probably, you know, baking with one's mum is probably a bit of a sort of cliche, but I'm not sure I helped very much. But I did, I did lick the inside of a lot of raw batter. I remember that.
Delicious. And was it your mother who mainly did most of the cooking?
Yeah, my mum worked growing up very hard. So she did do a lot of the cooking, but it was always a bit of a team effort. My dad helped chop the vegetables and my job was cutting the salad. I was keen to show off my newfound knife skills, I remember, as a kid. So I sort of took responsibility for cutting the salad. And my grandmother helped as well. So she lived with us half of the week. And so she shared the burden when it came to cooking.
And what sorts of meals would your mum be cooking?
So it was quite a bit of Indian food, because that's where my ancestry is from. My parents were actually both born in Africa and grew up in Africa. But the family ancestry is India. So it was quite a bit of Indian food, but not solely Indian food. And I think one of the things I liked most was Thursdays, because that was, I still remember, sort of treat day. And my grandmother used to try her hand at making Western food. So it was always Western food, but with a bit of an Indian twist. So I remember she used to put cumin in the pasta and do a sort of a little Indian twist on Western dishes. But I always quite enjoyed that.
And you mentioned licking cake batter. Was baking a staple part of your childhood?
My mother is a very, very good baker. So she makes an excellent carrot cake, which every Christmas and often throughout the year is a fixture. She also makes a very nice cheesecake and lots of things, actually. Indian sort of sweet treats as well. So yeah, baking was always quite big. My mum also loves a Black Forest gâteau. So sometimes she made it, but also sometimes she bought it. But I still have this vivid memory of her sort of parading round this Black Forest gâteau on a platter whenever people used to come round. And I sort of wrote about it recently, and I it sort of almost looked like the Imperial State Crown, you know, on this very elaborate cake platter.
Well, funny enough, you have to tell her to look out for Liv's next food column, which is about Black Forest gâteau.
Fantastic. BFG was a fixture of my childhood, and we'll recreate it when your column comes out, Liv.
And then, what about school food? Do you have happy memories?
I do. So I was quite lucky to be at a school which had proper school dinners provided, and I have very fond memories. I mean, I'm sort of a bit hopelessly sentimental and nostalgic. So I'm one of these people that does reminisce about school food and its very fond memories. I mean, I still can't quite believe that it was acceptable to have sponge cake and custard every single day for pudding. I mean, now that just seems totally disproportionate and outrageously unhealthy, but I did. And I even waged a campaign. I mean, it sounds pathetic in hindsight, but I had a little campaign to allow with the school to allow us to have seconds, because I remember always being very hungry even after finishing my lunch. And so I took this campaign to the powers that be at the school and demanded that, you know, we be allowed to go up for seconds. It was a bit pathetic in hindsight, but they did grant that. So I often had two lunches, but only after everyone else had finished. And I like to think that also helped reduce food waste. So that's my justification for it.
Oh, yeah, there's real virtue in the seconds.
And what about university? What was food like at that stage?
So at university, I had food at my college in the first and the third year, which was perfectly nice. Sort of an extension of school dinners, I guess. But in my second year, I lived out, and so I did more cooking. And it was, you know, fairly basic, because at uni, you know, we don't have time to make three-course meals. But I do remember having fun cooking with college flatmates, and I have one very strong memory of almost every week making masala beans on toast, which is a sort of Indian twist on typical beans on toast. So it's sort of jazzed up with lots of spices and fresh coriander and onion. And myself and my flatmate made that almost every week. So that was a fond memory.
And how did you go from sort of an academic university career and working in the Foreign Office to writing about food and cookery specifically?
So the Foreign Office is still my day job, and I essentially have always tried to maintain this interest in food and cooking and food writing on the site. So, I mean, when I left university, I spent a couple of years in the city at an investment fund, and then I left there and did a very brief stint as a professional chef. So I worked in a 2-Michelin-starred restaurant as a stagiaire. And it was a very short stint, but that gave me a taste of being a professional chef. So I enjoyed it, but I did decide, having done that short stint, that actually I wanted to keep up this interest in food, but not doing the grueling hours and very difficult career that being a professional chef involves. I remember it being slightly traumatizing. So I decided that I would take up the offer I had of joining Her Majesty's Diplomatic Service and keep up the interest in food on the side. And I've done that through having this pop-up restaurant in Pimlico, doing food writing for The Spectator and other publications, and now this book.
And in your work as a diplomat, how important is food as a diplomatic tool?
So this is the thing that inspired the whole book, really. And it's something that has consistently impressed me since joining the office, that food has this incredibly important role in the sort of diplomatic art and this incredibly important place in the diplomatic world. I mean, of course, there's so many clichés and stereotypes around this, around, you know, champagne and Ferrero Rochers at the ambassadorial cocktail parties. And, I mean, they bear little resemblance to the truth. You know, I can't remember ever having been served a Ferrero Rocher in my career to date. But, you know, notwithstanding, you know, food has this really important part. And you know, everyone knows that by sharing food with someone else, it's a foundation to build rapport and to get to know the other person and to get the other person to like you, if, you know, to put it bluntly. And the same is true in the world of diplomacy and at the high tables of power. And, you know, that's something that always interested me, and it's what led me to write the book.
So tell us about the book. What's the premise?
So the Platinum Jubilee Cookbook. So it comes out, as you say, in April, and it's really part collection of recipes from British embassies around the world, and part exploration of the role of food in diplomacy. So there's 70 recipes, and it won't have escaped you, 70 recipes is a deliberate attempt to mirror the 70 years that the Queen has spent on the throne. So 70 recipes, and then narrative, which explores this idea of food and the role it plays as a diplomatic tool. And then throughout as well, I profile lots of great British food products. So there's household names like Golden Tate and Lyle Golden Syrup or Cadbury's Chocolate, but also other brands that for example, are Royal Warrant Holding brands and have a connection to the monarchy that way. So it's a celebration of food, of Britishness, of the diplomatic world, and of the role that food plays in that.
And give us the flavour of the recipes within.
So there's a real mix, and I think this is what's really nice. So some are proudly British, and you know, the ones that spring to mind there are a recipe for a perfect Victoria sponge, or scones, or coconut cake fingers. But then there's also recipes which are authentically local. And for example, there is a recipe for chamole, which is probably the national dish of Belize. Or there is a recipe for, well, lots of the African recipes are very authentically local too. So it's a real mix. And actually some of my favourites are the ones which are a fusion of the two. So that are British but have a local twist. So the recipe contribution from Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia is a rendang beef Wellington. So a proudly British classic, but given a local twist. So it's a mixture of beef rendang and beef Wellington. And actually that was served to their Royal Highnesses, the Prince of Wales and the Duchess of Cornwall, when they went to Malaysia a few years ago. So lots of the dishes have a royal link in the sense that they were served to members of the royal family on their overseas visits.
And as well as the Platinum Jubilee cookbook, you've also come up with the idea for the Platinum Pudding.
Yes.
Which has now been taken on by Fortnum's.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
So the idea came to me in the shower, and all the best ideas come to me in the shower. And it occurred to me that we have a much loved classic in the Victoria sponge, and we needed something equivalent for our present wonderful Queen. So I thought, let's have a big national competition. We are a nation of bakers, after all, to invent a new pudding. And so that was the idea. And, you know, there's been so many dishes throughout history that have been named after famous people, everything from pavlova to Garibaldi biscuits, and also lots of dishes named after members of the British royal family. But we don't have something, except for coronation chicken, we don't have something for our present queen. So that was the idea. And yeah, I took the idea to the palace and to government colleagues and to Fortnum's, and it's grown from there into the Platinum Pudding competition.
And do you know how many entries it's had so far?
I can't give you an exact figure, but we've been bowled over with the amount of interest, and you know, thousands upon thousands of entries, and luckily the job of filtering them has fallen to the excellent team of Fortnum's chefs, as opposed to myself. But yeah, it's been a huge response, and I think that shows how much joy people get from baking, you know, particularly after the torrid couple of years we've had with COVID. I think people have sought real pleasure in baking, and I think also I loved the idea of, you know, grandchildren and grandparents, for example, have been separated for so long during the pandemic. I loved the idea that they would get together in the kitchen and, you know, bake together and produce something wonderful. And I think what's been lovely is to see the great variety in people entering, you know, everyone from young children to people in their 80s, you know, cooking in their care homes, for example. So it's been lovely.
And at home, what do you enjoy baking or cooking?
So at home, I cook almost everything, but I particularly like making simple curries. I am amazed how easy it is to make a curry, but how difficult people think it is. You know, it's almost one of those things that people are quite intimidated to make, but it's so easy and you just need three or four spices and some onions, you know, or not even some onions. And, you know, you've got the foundation for a curry. So I cook lots of curries, but, you know, all sorts, really. Things that are quite quick and easy, you know, egg fried rice or simple stir fries. I'm a big fan of Asian food, so I cook that as well. But and British classics, when I think on the weekend when I have a bit more time, that's when I'll make a pie or something like that, where I can turn on the radio and pour a glass of wine and sort of relax into it.
Amir, what is your comfort food?
My comfort food is probably an Indian dish. It's called khichdi. It's actually the foundation or the genesis behind khichdi, which you'll know. But the original Indian dish doesn't have smoked haddock and doesn't have boiled eggs. It's almost just like a porridge-like rice dish, almost like an Indian risotto. And it's very, very comforting. And I have strong memories of my grandmother making it and topping it with a thick slab of anchor butter, which melted in a pool on top. So that has to be my ultimate comfort food.
And what about eating out? Which restaurants or bars do you like to frequent?
So I live locally in Westminster in a tiny little flat, but I'm lucky to be so central. And there is some real hidden gems, I think, in Westminster. My favourite is probably, I'm slightly reluctant to give the name, but I don't want to let the secret out, but it's essentially a cabbie's restaurant, which does amazing Italian food. I'm going to give the name. It's called Sapori's. And the first time I went there, I couldn't understand why everyone had this gold medallion around their neck and everyone was drinking tea or cappuccino with their pasta as opposed to a glass of red wine. And then, of course, I realized that they were all black cab drivers, and so they couldn't drink on the job. And the medallion was evidence of them having passed that notorious test or whatever it was to become a black cab driver. So it's an amazing place and incredibly cheap and very filling portions, because it's meant to fuel the cabbies as they sort of take a pit stop in the middle of the night.
And to finish, we normally ask, what would your desert island meal be?
So I knew you were going to ask this. So I've actually
listened to previous episodes.
Exactly. And I've thought about this very hard. So the starter would be my mum's samosas. They are filled with bird's eye peas, and the tortilla wrapping is actually comes from the United States, because in our family we take samosas incredibly seriously. So, and my mother is convinced that the very best tortilla wraps for the samosas casing come from the US. So every time my auntie comes over here, she's instructed to pack about a dozen packets of tortilla wraps in her suitcase. So that would be the starter. And then the main is probably fish and chips, eaten out of the paper with huge amounts of salt and vinegar. It's hard to beat. And for dessert, for pudding, a traditional British sponge pudding with custard, maybe sticky toffee pudding, or maybe even the platinum pudding when it is finally
when it's finally revealed.
But yeah, I have a soft spot for a cake and custard.
That's my kind of menu.
That sounds delicious. Amir, thank you very much for joining Table Talk. And Amir's book will be out on the 28th of April.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Table Talk. If you enjoyed it, please do leave us a rating and review. For more recipes and recommendations, sign up to The Spectator's free monthly food and drink email, The Takeaway, written by me, Olivia Potts. Sign up at www.spectator.co.uk/Olivia Potts.